did the early Catholic Church look like to other Roman citizens? This is part two of that discussion.
What we're setting straight here is a common misconception today about what the early Catholic Church was like, because that was the church. It was far more organized than the sort of foggy, vague picture that we're usually presented.
Of a loose band of individuals who are following Christ, not much organization, but following the words of Christ.
It was much more than that.
So let us set the record straight.
In part one, we talked about putting our time boots on and imagining that we were two Roman gentlemen, perhaps senators, walking to our official duties and passing among the buildings in the center of Rome and seeing the magnificent Jewish temple, seeing the smaller pagan temples, and also the small Catholic building that was so distinct from all the others.
Now, it wasn't that distinct in architecture. I meant it was distinct in what went on within it.
Especially distinct in the disciplined organization of its hierarchy, and also in the body as a whole, in its general spirit. It differed from everything around it in this double character of precision and conviction. This was a skeptical age. We're in the beginning of the 3rd century. Very skeptical. There was no certitude left, no definite spirit, no mental aim, no dogma.
That's a term we would use today, no dogma.
Taken for granted in the Lyons of his time. But there was one group where there was certitude. It was among the Catholics.
The pagan masses were attached,
this is without a definite religion, to a number of customs. In social morals, they were guided by certain institutions at the foundation of which were the Roman ideas of property and men, land and goods. Patriotism, the bond of smaller societies, had long ago merged in the conception of a universal empire. This was truly a European Union, but it was pan-Mediterranean.
You know, they say history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. In the Renaissance, they made the attempt to return to that sort of secularized, great uniform empire of Rome of the time that we're walking through the streets in, where religions had sort of neutralized each other, been neutered.
And to imitate the discipline of the Romans, who had written statutes and controls.
And they attempted that again in the European Union, to sort of secularize and return to this dream of what Rome had once been, indifferent to religion but having certain ethics and morals.
The rhyme is, we're seeing a move to break up the European Union, just as Rome was broken up.
Because what is the adhesive that bonds society together?
You know the answer. I don't have to tell you.
It's the cult, the religion, that is the center of culture. Everything is downstream of that.
If that fails, everything fails.
Once again, history is rhyming. But let's get back to our thoughts as we, the two senators, stroll through the streets of Lyon in the 3rd century. We knew what was different about this Catholic Church.
The Catholic Church alone represented a complete theory of life to which men were attached, as they had hundreds of years before been attached to their local city, with its local gods and intense corporate local life. As senators, we would have been concerned about the presence of this church. It was small, but no longer negligible. It was emerging as a permanent force. And what's more, as a state within the state. So, like most of the nobles of his generation, the Catholic Church would affected us as an irritant. Its existence interfered with the general routine of public affairs.
It was the only exceptional organism of this otherwise uniform time. And what's more, it was growing, it was growing.
If it had been adherent to both of us, why? Well, in the first place, there had been in our society, from time to time, some acute spasmodic friction breaking out between the imperial power and this separate voluntary organism, the Catholic Church. The Church's partial secrecy, its high vitality, its claim to independent administration, were the superficial causes of this. Now, speaking as Catholics today, we know that the ultimate causes were much, much more profound. The conflict was a conflict between Jesus Christ, with his great foundation on one hand, and what Jesus Christ himself had called on the other hand, the world. Well, it's a little unhistorical to think of a pagan world as opposed to a Catholic world at that time. The very conception of a pagan world require some external manifest Catholic civilization against which to contrast it. Well, there was nothing like that, of course. The Church had around her, in the first generation of the 3rd century, a society which education was very widely spread, intellectual curiosity very lively, a society largely skeptical, but interested to discover the right conduct of human life. There was a great deal of individual freedom and variety of behaviors. A cruel man could be cruel in it without suffering the punishment which centuries of Catholic training would render natural to our ideas. But a merciful man could be, and would be, merciful, and would preach mercy, and would be generally applauded. Remember, it was a society in which there were many ascetics, whole schools of thought contemptuous of sensual pleasure. But it was a society distinguished from the Catholic, particularly in this, that at the bottom it believed man to be sufficient to himself, and all belief was just opinions. Everybody was entitled to his own opinion. So, in the 3rd century, this was the great antithesis between the Catholic Church and her surrounding, and it is an antithesis which has been revived today in our secular skeptical time. Today, outside the Catholic Church, there is no distinction between opinion and faith. No distinction between opinion and faith. Nor any idea that man is other than very sufficient to himself. Well, the Catholic Church did not then and does not now believe man to be sufficient to himself. It differed from, or was just more solid than all around it, in this. That it proposed statements instead of hypotheses, affirmed concrete historical facts instead of suggesting myths, and treated its rituals of mysteries as realities instead of as symbols. Now, anybody with historical knowledge knows that the Catholic Church in the years 200 to 250 was an organized society under bishops. There was a central primacy at Rome, as well as local primacies in various other great cities. But how did the Catholic society look at itself? Well, one way to understand how they looked at themselves and at the church they were members of is to remember the distinction pointed out by Hilaire Belloc, the great Catholic writer. Belloc wrote that it was unhistorical to use the word Christianity. It connotes something very different than what we intended to. Christianity is a term that arose with the post-Reformation writers and speakers. It connotes an opinion or a theory, a point of view, an idea. The Catholics of the time of which I speak had no such conception. No, they were attached to its very antithesis. They were attached to the conception of a thing, of an organized body instituted for a definite end, disciplined in a definite way, and remarkable for the possession of definite and concrete doctrine. Now, one can be talking about that time and use the term Stoicism, ism being the suffix, or Epicureanism, or Neoplatonism, but one cannot talk of Christianism or Christism. Indeed, no one has been so ignorant to attempt those phrases. But the term Christianity, used by moderns as identical with the Catholic body in the 3rd century, is intellectually the equivalent of Christianism or Christism. It connotes a grossly unhistorical idea. It connotes something historically false, something that never existed. To clarify this, let's continue our story. Let's move to another location in the year 225. How about a private house in Carthage? 5 men sit in this house. One is the host. They're all men of culture, all possessed of the 2 languages, Greek and Latin, well-read and interested in the problems and half-solutions of their skeptical time. One will profess himself a materialist and will find another to agree with him. There is no personal God. Certain moral duties must be recognized by men for such and such utilitarian reasons. He finds support among the others. The host is not of that opinion. He's been profoundly influenced by certain mysteries into which he has been initiated. These mysteries, rituals, are plays that symbolically show the fate of the soul and performed in high seclusion before members of a society sworn to secrecy. He's come to feel a spiritual life as the natural life around him. He has curiously followed and often paid at high expense the services of necromancers. He believes that in initiation, which he's experienced in his youth,
And during the secret and most vivid drama, or mystery, in which he took part, he actually came in contact with the spiritual world. Now, such men were numerous. The declining society of the time was already turning to influences of that type. Look around you, the New Age reemerges again today in our declining society. The host's convictions, his awed and reticent attitude towards such thing, impresses the guest. Among the guests is a rather simple, solid kind of man, and he's not drawn to such fantasies and vagaries. His name is Ferriolus. He says he's been reading with great interest the literature of the Catholics. He is in admiration of the traditional figure of the founder of their church. He quotes passages from the four Orthodox Gospels. They move this simple man to eloquence, and their poignancy and their illuminating power have an effect on his friends. He says, "For my part, I've come to make it a sort of rule to act as this man Christ would have had me act." He seems to me to have led a perfect life, the most perfect I've ever read of. And when you are conscious of all that he said, it seems to comprise a complete guide to life. This is the path on which I found myself, and I don't think I'm ever going to leave it. They all fall silent, having listened to Ferriolus and what he had to say. Now I ask you, would Ferriolus have been a Christian? Would the officials of the Roman Empire have called him a Christian? Would he have been in danger of unpopularity where Christians were unpopular? Would Christians have received him among themselves as part of their strict and still somewhat secret society? Well, the answer is most emphatically, no. No, he would not. No Catholic congregation of that time would have regarded him as in any way connected to them, or with their body, with their organism. Opinions of that sort were opinions, Christism, and had no relation to the actual church. It would have been one more of those sets of vague opinions which floated about the cultured Roman world. So what we're saying is that the term Christianity, used as a point of view, a mere mental attitude, would include this man, Ferriolus. And it is equally evident that we have only to imagine him to see that he had nothing to do with the Catholic religion of that day. For the Catholic religion then and now was a thing, not a theory. It was expressed in what I've called an organism. Now someone may want to interrupt my thought here and say, surely there was heresy after heresy, and thousands of men at any moment were claiming the name of Christian, whom the Orthodox Church rejected. Some suffered martyrdom rather than relinquish the name Christian. But I reply that the existence of such sects would be enough to prove the pointed issue. Those sects arose precisely because within the Catholic Church were these things, three things: exact doctrine, unbroken tradition, and three, absolute unity. All three of these were regarded as the necessary marks of the institution. The common way in these times for a heresy to arise was that in the early church, some doctrines were not yet fully defined, and after debate and council, and also authoritative statement on part of the bishops, an orthodox truth is defined. And what if someone disagrees? The man may cease to be in communion if he doesn't change his mind, and his rejection, no less than his own original insistence upon his doctrine, are in themselves proof that both he and the judges believe that necessary marks, two necessary marks of Catholic truth, are unity and definition. So there was a common Catholic doctrine held everywhere that the Catholic Church was in the first years of the 3rd century. We could discuss it briefly if you'd like to listen. I'll do it. Let's take a writer like Tertullian and listen to what the body of truth was in his time. In the year 200, Tertullian was about 40 years old. The Church then taught as an unbroken tradition that a man, with a capital M, who had been put to death about 170 years before in Palestine, that's 130 years before Tertullian's birth, had risen again on the third day. This man was a known and real person with whom many people had had conversation. In Tertullian's childhood, men still lived who had been eyewitnesses of the activities of this man. The Catholic Church said that this man was also the supreme creator God. There you have an apparent contradiction in terms, or at any rate a mystery, fruitful in opportunities for theory, and as a fact destined to lead to 3 centuries of more and more particular definition. This man who was God had, through chosen companion called apostles, founded a strict and disciplined society called the Church. The doctrines taught by this man were taught by the Church. They included the immortality of the soul, its redemption, its alternative of a salvation and damnation. Initiation into the Church was by way of baptism with water in the name of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Before his death, this man, who was also God, had instituted a certain rite, had instituted a mystery called the Eucharist. He took bread and wine and changed them into his own body and blood. He ordered this rite to be continued. The central act of worship of the Christian Church was therefore a consecration of bread and wine by the priests in the presence of the initiated and baptized Catholic body of the locality. The bread and wine so consecrated were certainly called the body of the Lord. That was universal. The faithful also certainly ate the bread and drank the wine, and thus changed in the mystery. It was the central rite of the Church thus to take the body of the Lord. There was certainly at the head of each Catholic community a bishop regarded as directly the successor of the apostles, the chief agent of the ritual and the guardian of doctrine. The whole increasing body of local communities kept in touch through their bishops, held one doctrine and practiced what was substantially one truth, one ritual. All that's plain history. The numerical proportion of the Church in the city of Carthage, because that's where Tertullian wrote, was large enough for its general suppression to be impossible. One might argue from one of his phrases that it was a tenth of the population. There were a very large number of converts. The majority of the population of his time of the Catholic Church were recruited through conversion and were not born Catholics. This is a very, very brief outline of the Catholic Church in its early years. This was the undisputed manner of the Church to anyone that knows history, and as an inquiring pagan would have been acquainted with in the years 160 to 200 AD and onwards. I'm going to do a part 3 on this subject. It's sort of interesting. And I credit Hilaire Belloc for most of this material. See you next time on Setting the Record Straight on Breadbox Media. I'm Chuck Coughlin. God bless you. Have a good day.